This is the Lubetkin on Communications podcast, episode 48 for Wednesday, February 23rd, 2011. Hello and welcome to the Lubetkin on Communications podcast. I'm your podcast host, Steve Lubetkin. In this episode of our podcast, we present a PRSA Delaware Meet the Media panel. The participants in the panel are media covering business in Delaware. It's a panel of local business reporters sharing stories behind the headlines in Delaware and the greater Philadelphia area. Our panelists are Amy Cherry from 1150 AM WDEL, Joseph DeStefano from the Philadelphia Inquirer, and Jonathan Starkey from the News Journal of Wilmington. Amy Cherry is an award-winning general assignment reporter and news anchor for 1150 AM WDEL. She covers everything from crime and business to education, politics, and human interest. If it's happening in Delaware, Amy's on it. She came to Delaware from WBZ AM in Boston, where she was editor. She's a member of the Delaware Press Association and the Chesapeake Associated Press Broadcasters Association. And you can follow WDEL Radio on Twitter at WDEL, with an at sign in front of it. Joe DeStefano was one of the very first interviews on our Middle Chamber Books podcast for his book Comcasted, about the Comcast cable company that's headquartered in Philadelphia. Joe writes a business column in the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Philly Deals blog. He's worked at the Inquirer more often than not since 1988, leaving a couple of times to make more money elsewhere and coming back when the Inquirer matched his pay. He's also worked at the News Journal, where he had a column in the early 90s, and at Bloomberg News, where he spent 2007 covering the early stages of the financial crisis at Citigroup and J.P. Morgan. As I mentioned, he's the author of Comcasted, a book about Philadelphia's largest company, which, as you'll hear, still hasn't forgiven him for writing it. He's a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania and last year taught a senior writing seminar at St. Joe's University's Halp Business School. Joe lives north of Wilmington with his wife and six kids. You can follow the Philadelphia Inquirer on Twitter at philly.com. And Jonathan Starkey covers autos, pharmaceuticals, health insurance issues, and DuPont for the News Journal in Wilmington. Before coming to the paper in February 2010, he freelanced for Newsday and the Washington Post, and his Twitter handle is JW Starkey. The program lasts about an hour and includes a question and answer period from the audience.
Good morning, everyone. I am Nikki Lavoie. I am the chapter delegate for Public Relations Society of America, Delaware chapter. I'm also the communications manager for the Delaware Economic Development Office. So as you might expect, I'm especially pleased to join my colleagues in presenting today's program on business reporting. But before I introduce our speakers this morning, a few housekeeping items. The first of which is today our program is going to be podcasted for the very first time. We've not done it before, and we're doing so with the generous offer of Podcast Steve. Say hello. So he'll be coming around with a wireless mic at the conclusion of our speaker's remarks, so that if you have questions, you can ask the questions into the mic. Be sure to wait for that. We're also fortunate to have some members of Public Relations Society of America here today. If you are not a member already and you are attending at the non-member rate, keep in mind that for February, your Delaware chapter membership is free with your national membership, and there's information at the front desk. Members of our board are in attendance today. In addition to me, we have Marcia Hook in the back. Say hello, Marcia. Jeff Jackson, say hello. I didn't see Spiros. Is Spiros here? All right, Spiros is not here. Dan Tipton of Tipton Communications also couldn't make it today. And did I miss someone else today? Is that just us today? You got us. We have a couple of past board presidents, including Karen. Karen, say hello. Oh, there we are. and Jeff, who is our board secretary, is also a past president as well. We are very fortunate to have a very cooperative partnership with our student chapter at the University of Delaware, Public Relations Student Society of America, PRSSA. And today we have Alex Albanese with us today. He joined us this morning and helped us out to set things up, and we were fortunate to have one or two students attend all of our programs. I encourage you to say hello and meet him, and I'm going to ask him to say one or two words and introduce himself to all of you.
Thank you for that introduction, and I thank PRSA for letting me have this experience to come up and talk to all of you. Just a few things about myself. I come from the University of Delaware. I'm a communications major, a Spanish minor. I first became interested in public relations after taking a communications class, and I was sent to go talk to David Braun as part of an interview project to become affiliated with public relations. And after hearing about all of his accomplishments, I really became interested in how public relations works and how to actually get better, to set goals and to evaluate them. So I became really interested in that. As far as that, I'm interested in just becoming active in any way I can, and just to be part of the public relations profession. Thank you for this time.
Thanks, Alex. Now to our speakers. So we have three speakers on our media panel today. I'm very happy that they've agreed to speak. That none of them kicked and screamed. They all accepted with ease, actually. So
free breakfast.
Free breakfast, of course. Although you could probably get a pretty inexpensive breakfast at the Post House and a nice comfy stool in Newark. I don't know that you had to come to the Hilton for that. But nonetheless, they're here and I'm glad for it. So first we have here Joe DiStefano, and he's with the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's a business reporter, and he also writes Philly Deals blog, which I'm sure many of you have seen. If you follow us on Twitter, you may have read his most recent blog on Delaware, which I posted as well. And he'll tell you a little bit more about himself. We also have Amy Cherry with WDEL Radio. She's comes to us after being in Delaware a couple of years from Boston. And she's a general assignment reporter. There's not a lot of business writing in radio specifically. You see that a lot in print, particularly in this area. But Amy's going to tell you a little bit about how radio is a little bit different and her duties as a general assignment and what she covers in business. And then you have John on the end, John Starkey with the News Journal. And John is a business reporter. I get to talk to him almost on a daily basis, lucky me. And we're very pleased to have them. Please give them a round of applause. I think the gentlemen have opted to let the lady speak first. So, Amy?
Good morning, everyone. I am a general assignment and legislative reporter for 1150 AM, WDEL. I came to Delaware about a year ago, as Nikki said, from Boston, where I worked at WBZ Radio. And I actually got my start there by working in the New England business segment. But I'll talk a little bit more about that later. I want to tell you about my job here in Delaware first. And I think my favorite parts about my job are twofold. Number one is talking to you. And number two is the fact that I do something different every day. Just to give you a general idea, Monday I might be at State Police Headquarters covering a serial rapist press conference. Tuesday I might be down at Legislative Hall covering a bill filing. Wednesday I might be at the governor as he's signing a bill or making an announcement about an economic development initiative that he's trying to push. Maybe Thursday, it might be a snow day, and I might be in Rockford Park covering kids sledding. And Friday, I might be covering a business healthcare story or something like the M&T acquisition of Wilmington Trust. So every day, to give you an idea, is something different for me. Later on today, I'm covering the state employees collective bargaining rally downtown. So every day is something a little bit different. And I guess in the span of 1 week, I'm covering everything from crime to feature stories to human interest to legislative stuff to business and healthcare. And I'm expected to be an expert in everything that I cover. And that can be kind of a challenge. And I think that the benefit that the other two panelists, John and Joe, have over me is that they get to talk to you every day, at least on a weekly basis. They have a lot of your cell phone numbers, they know how to get the job done, and they get in touch with you. And that's a big part of the reason why I'm here, because I want to get to know you better. And I want to be able to do that as well for Delaware. So the other challenge that I face in my job is that I don't have 1,000 words. I don't even have 100 words. I have to tell your story in 40 seconds or less. Six sentences, usually, that turns out to be.
Yeah, it's
a challenge. So if you send me a 2 or 3 page press release kind of going over everything, it only kind of makes my job harder. For the web, you know, we can go into more depth, but for the radio, it's 40 seconds and I'm out. That includes me and you talking. So if you can't explain it in less than a minute, it makes it hard for me to do so as well. The story needs to catch my attention, and I guess one of the biggest things to remember is that no good journalist is going to ever turn down a good story. And the best thing I can advise is in a press release to keep it simple, but also tell me what's going on. Don't be cryptic. Don't make me wonder whether I should be coming to your event or not. Don't make me ask questions when I see, you know, obviously I'm a journalist, I'm going to have questions, but don't make me question what is this event about, I guess. And also, I think that's the beauty of an embargo as well. You can tell me what's going on and I cannot report it until you tell me the start of the press conference or the end of the press conference. Embargoes really help us in radio, I think, in that sense. And although, you know, we do have a large broadcast news team in Delaware, we don't have 100 reporters to throw at a story. We have three full-time reporters and a staff of part-time reporters who, some live in Philadelphia, they live in the area, but they have other jobs too. So we don't have the luxury of having beat reporters, and we need to make a timely decision on whether to cover a news event. So that's where the importance of your media alert or your press release comes in. And one thing to remember about the radio medium is that it is the fastest way to get information out to the masses of people. I mean, it can start with just the who, what, when, and where, and the why and how can come later. I have regular news deadlines every single half hour, and I can break into regular programming, aka the talk shows, Rick Jensen and Al Mazzetti that you hear. I can break into those at any time if the news is worthy of it. So getting in touch with me is key in terms of getting your information out to a mass audience. You know, and at first, we can just stick with the basics. That way we get the story out there. And the how and the why can come later. And I think if there's a new development, you know, of course I'm going to be calling you, but you should call me too. That way I'm not annoying you at a critical time. So if there's a new development, call me. Tell me about it. And then we can talk. As Delaware's local source of news, I think a lot of what we do is fueled by video content. And the biggest thing that people always ask me is, you're a radio reporter, why do you have a video camera? And it's because everything needs to be accessible on the web nowadays. And the more video content you have on your website, the better your website is. If you have a video element that makes your story more compelling, tell me about it so that I come to your news conference and I have my camera and we'll shoot it. Men and women standing around in suits, kind of just holding a microphone, doesn't really make the most compelling of videos, but if you have charts and graphics and things that can go alongside to better explain what you're doing, then visually we can better explain it to the people. So I think that really helps as well. The same things that are going to draw a Philadelphia TV station, Channel 6, Channel 10 to your news conference are the same things that are going to draw me there. You know, it's the graphics. And that being said, in TV, there is the expression, if it bleeds, it leads. That's not true in radio, so we're not exactly the same. Our main element is sound. Just because we have video of a fire doesn't mean that we're going to leave with that story about a fire if your business did something awesome. So I think that makes us different in terms of television from standing out. Our primary source is always going to be sound and the best story. So I'm looking for a sound bite, but if there's great video to go along with it too, that makes it compelling, then that's even better, and there's a way bigger chance I'm going to show up at your news conference. Too often people, I think, see my video camera and they kind of freak out a little bit too. They're like, oh, I don't want to be on camera. I'll talk on the radio because no one knows can see my face. They're much more comfortable talking to you guys, honestly, because you've got the pen and the paper and it seems more like a conversation where it seems more formal when I have my video camera and my microphone. So I think that's one of the struggles that I face. And, you know, if you're not the best person to do the interview, that's fine. I'm glad you admit it. But find me someone who is within your department who can really tell the story and give me the color that I need. You know, I can spew out the facts, but you telling me how what your business is doing affects the people is really what I'm looking for here. I can say, you know, I can spew out the facts. I need the color from you. And I think sometimes the best stories of all stories come from just listening to people and talking to your friends. And it was exactly that which led me to one of the best stories that I covered so far, business-wise. In Boston, I researched, wrote, and reported an exclusive story that led to a sports marketing scam in 2008 that was targeting college students. SJS Acquisitions was headquartered in Burlington, Massachusetts, which is about 30 miles outside Boston. And later I found, as I'm reporting, I found out that it didn't really have a headquarters at all. SJS Acquisitions would post on everywhere a college grad would look for a job. Monster.com, Career Builder, Craigslist, you name it. They were everywhere. Their ads were everywhere. And they promised the opportunity to work with top clients like the Boston Red Sox and the New York Yankees. And alarm went off in my head that no company would probably work with both rival teams. But, you know, that struck a chord with me initially. And the more people I talked to, the more people I found seeking a job from this company that was so far from what was advertised, it wasn't even funny. I found several companies just like SJS Marketing. One of them was Sky High Marketing, another was Nova Marketing. Those come to mind. And they all had flashy websites with similar promises and worked with the same clients and had these testimonial sections that were nearly identical. So I checked out one of the interview sites. It was clearly a rented office space in a warehouse with mismatched furniture and a receptionist that couldn't really tell me what was going on. When people went on these interviews, they were told their second interview would be 8 hours long. They were told to dress professionally, but wear walking shoes and don't forget their umbrella. So what the one recent college grad that I talked to who became a victim of this scam, essentially, he found out that he would be going door to door in southern New Hampshire, not even in Massachusetts, soliciting people with coupon pamphlets that had nothing to do with sports whatsoever. And they said that the opportunity would eventually lead them to work with top clients. And he made one third of however many coupon pamphlets he sold. So I'm not sure where the salary promises came from. I wrote to the Attorney General's office, the Consumer Protection Bureau, I talked to the Better Business Bureau, and of course I called the company president, to which none of my calls were returned. The Attorney General's office told me they didn't have time to investigate all complaints, and the Better Business Bureau led me to a website called ripoffreport.com, where I saw some other complaints about this company. And within a few days of running the story, we got so many calls from parents saying, my hardworking college student fell for this scam too, and you know, they go to college and they get these wonderful degrees and they work so hard, and then they go on an interview like this, and it makes them feel like they can't make it in the world, especially during these economic times. And I think that the best part about all of this was a few days later, SJS Acquisitions and their flashy website were gone. They vanished, just out of thin air. And I think good journalism compels action like that, and it brings about change. And while that was one of my proudest moments, I think, in business reporting, and I wanted to share it with you. And though it didn't involve any public relations persons in general, that doesn't mean a great story won't, and that the biggest stories aren't always the greatest. I think that's something to keep in mind. If you're looking for ways to get more coverage for non-breaking news stories, we at WDEL, we're always looking for human interest stories, or what we call evergreen stories, for Mondays, especially, and holidays. Ideas that I can throw out at you is your company marking a milestone or making a major change that the people should know about? Are you getting a federal grant that helps you with research, or do you have someone on staff who is a hero, or maybe has an interesting hobby, or just is somewhat eclectic? Do you have experts that can help us localize a national story? That's something that we're always looking for, ties to national and international stories. And the next best thing, honestly, if there is honestly no local tie, is a local expert weighing in and giving their opinion. I also produce a weekly feature called Education Watch, so I'm always looking for material for that. If there's anyone out there in this audience that works for an educational nonprofit, we should talk. If you're a parent and your child's doing something cool at school, we should talk too. I mean, there's no limit to the things that we can fit onto the air in WDEL. And I think the bottom line here is that we should always be talking. I mean, you may have an employee that puts their life on the line, and we may not know about it. We're always going to be at the big fire, but we won't know if your company is doing something truly historic unless you tell us. So even the smaller incidents, it's important that you keep me in the loop, and we can help each other that way. So thank you.
You want to go, John, or you want me to go?
I guess I can.
All right.
Second you.
So
Arthur.
Good morning. I appreciate being invited to this event by Nikki, who she very politely pointed out that I bug her on occasion. So wanted to give you a bit of background about how I came to work at the News Journal and in journalism generally. So I'm from Dover, Delaware, attended school undergraduate at Salisbury University, got out of school 2003. I accepted my first journalism job in 2004 at a small weekly in Sussex County, Delaware, the Milford Chronicle, which is actually a weekly of the Delaware State News. I covered part-time sports, so we covered everything from Pop Warner football games to high school sports to kind of localizing national sports issues. Moved on. My first news job was at a weekly in Ocean View, Delaware, where I don't know if any of you guys deal with weekly reporters on occasion, but they cover absolutely everything. It's a fascinating job. It's actually sort of like Amy described in that you're a general assignment reporter and you cover everything that matters to a certain community. So I went back to school, studied journalism for my master's degree at New York University, graduated 2008. So my the 3 years or 4 years preceding my time at the News Journal was spent freelancing. I wrote mainly on personal finance for Newsday, and it's a regional newspaper on Long Island, for the Washington Post, and some for the News Journal, as well as some regional magazines like Delaware Beach Life. So I came back to Delaware in February of 2010 to accept a job, actually as an education reporter, moved quickly into business, and now my beat includes chemicals, pharmaceuticals, so I covered DuPont, AstraZeneca, the entire kind of life sciences scene in northern Delaware, as well as chickens downstate, which we actually don't cover as much as we should because there's a lot of people kind of chasing chickens around in Sussex County.
Most of them don't read English, however.
That may very well be true. And I also cover general economic and finance issues. And so I guess I've been asked here today to talk about what beat reporting is in 2011. So I actually think it's a pretty fascinating issue because I don't think it's a big surprise. This is not particular to the News Journal. Every paper of this size across the country and larger papers have kind of been through a pretty tumultuous time in the past several years. I don't know of a paper that has as many resources today as they had 5-10 years ago. So what that means is we have kind of fewer people covering as many things or more on the business desk. I think the last couple of years has taught us that kind of business reporting is not a niche section, and people should understand what's going on in the economy and finance and their local businesses, because at any minute it can kind of have an impact on your job or your investments. Or just your way of life. I mean, I'm sure everybody's 401k in here is smaller than it was a couple years ago. Fortunately, we've seen a pretty good rebound, but I think it's been a premium placed on business reporting. That said, I think there's a lot of pressures. Well, let me back up. I think the advantages of beat reporting are, as Amy mentioned, you have a reporter who's able to delve into a particular issue. So for example, I cover pharmaceuticals, so I can spend week after week after week talking to people in the pharmaceutical sector in Delaware and understanding what the issues are and helping kind of explain to people how that affects their everyday life in Delaware. Over the years and months, you develop a kind of bank of institutional knowledge that you can draw from and explain to readers why a particular move is important or not important. I think how the last couple years and the last 5-10 years and the kind of drain of resources in journalism has affected beat reportings has made beats massive. I mean, I think 10 years ago or 15 years ago, it would have been legitimate to have a chemicals reporter in Delaware. Today, the chemicals reporter at the News Journal covers, as I said, pharmaceuticals, covers chickens, covers the economy and finance, and whatever other general assignment story that kind of comes across your desk. In a way, I think that's done something incredible for the paper. Because if you had, so for example, we have three reporters covering business. If you had 10 reporters, you could cover everything. I mean, you could be on the ground for kind of small breaking news in each of these segments every day. So we could cover everything that comes out of AstraZeneca, or everything that comes out of DuPont, or everything that comes out of the life sciences scene. What actually this resources drain has done to us is made us more selective in how we use our time. So, which really, you know, which is a good thing. We have to, you know, justify why we're doing one story or another. So for me, it comes down to kind of points of intersection. So what does a DuPont story say, or what does an AstraZeneca story say about something else in Delaware? So what does, so we wrote a story last week about DuPont expanding ag research in Delaware. To me, it was a good story, not because it's something that DuPont is doing, which 15 years ago may have been enough. DuPont, you know, in the early 90s, late 80s, employed 30,000 people in Delaware. Its every move was probably worth covering. Today, they employ about 8,000. I think there probably should be a higher standard for how we select stories and what we cover that comes out of DuPont. So this, to me, was an interesting story because they're investing $50 million over the next 5 years to expand agricultural biotech research in Delaware. I thought that was a great story. It led A1, it led the front page of the next day's paper because it showed that DuPont was investing money in its largest business in Delaware to create jobs here. So it was kind of the intersection of DuPont's biggest business and job creation in Delaware. And I think job creation and kind of how businesses' investments affect the labor workforce, or how business cost cutting affects the labor workforce, can be a beat unto itself today. So another example is AstraZeneca. We wrote a story recently about AstraZeneca, some of the challenges that AstraZeneca faces from generic drug makers. So I don't know if anybody in here follows the pharmaceutical industry very closely, but you know, several of the company's top-selling drugs over the next several years lose patent protection in the United States. That likely will cost billions from the top line. That is a legitimate story for Bloomberg, the Wall Street Journal, on its merits. This is a big business that is going to lose a lot of money over the next several years that a lot of people are invested in. For us, I think there has to be another point of intersection. So we have to, I think, because we have fewer resources to throw at a story today, and because that, you know, demands that we use our time more wisely and explain why any particular business decision matters to people, we have to take it a step further and say, okay, AstraZeneca, this local company, is facing a pressure, so what does that mean to Delaware? And what it means to Delaware is potentially more cost cutting, and potential more cost cutting means potential more loss of jobs in Delaware. And so I just think we're always looking for that next step. So to help explain what a certain business decision, not just explain the particular business decision, but explain how it, you know, what else it means. So will it ultimately mean growth of jobs in Delaware, or will it mean the loss of jobs in Delaware? And I don't think our beats have particularly kept up with this, my beat, for example, when I accepted the position, was explained to me as a list of companies or a list of industries that we cover. So I'm still focusing my time covering the pharmaceutical industry and chemicals and chicken and financing the economy. I think that beats tomorrow will be more focused around these points of intersection. So we'll say, how does big business affect the labor market in Delaware? Or how does government interplay in business affect, what is the intersection of government regulation in business? I mean, I think that's a story that has become more fascinating by the day because we have a pretty active administration in the state now that when it comes to business and job creation. I mean, I think Governor Markell and Alan Levin, who heads DITO, see themselves as job creators, as trying to you know, attract businesses here and create jobs. So I think that kind of government interplay with business could be a beat unto itself. And I think that every reporter at the News Journal has kind of developed a niche, has developed, you know, we look for important stories, and every important story has a set of characteristics. It takes a business decision and moves it beyond that business decision and says, what does this mean for Delaware in general? What does this mean for Delaware job creation? Or what does this say about how government is interacting with business? So as PR people, I think, I don't know if this is unsolicited advice, I hope it's not, but as PR people, I think that helping or trying to understand what that point of intersection is, so what actually makes us think a story is worth investing time in, understanding where those points of intersection are will help you pitch a story to us that lands in the paper or lands on the front page of the paper. For me, that would be easy. I mean, I have no problem, you know, obviously accepting a call from anybody at any time of the day. So if you want to know from me what I think a good story is, you should pick up the phone and give me a call and say, what types of stories are you interested in? I mean, I completely understand that most PR people are not interested in saying, hey, we've got this great story about 50 people we're laying off next week. I don't think that, I think that's something we're probably going to have to uncover on our own if that's happening. But we're just as interested in job creation as we are in job loss. And if you think that a particular business decision at one of your businesses says something greater about the economy or says something about where Delaware's business scene is headed, or says something about where the life sciences scene is headed in Delaware, or says something about how government is being proactive to attract businesses to Delaware, or government regulation is changing in some way and kind of affecting the way businesses do business here. I think all of those are great stories, but they have to move beyond here's a decision we're making or here's a particular hire that we've made. It's got to say something else, because they're, you know. We had six reporters on the business desk as recently as 2005. We have three and an editor today, and I think we definitely choose our stories more wisely. Like I said, I think there's a huge positive to that. I think it has made us do something that we should have done anyway, which is be much more selective in the stories we tell in the paper every day. And like I said, I'm kind of hammering this point home, I do believe that every story we write has to say something else. There has to be significance about the story topic. It can't stand on its on it, on the business decision or the particular hire. So, with that said, I endorse everything that Amy said about press releases. We obviously like clear press releases that explain exactly what's going on. And please send them as often as possible. But open lines of dialogue are great as well. I like to chat with people, and if anybody wants to give me a call at any time and try to help me understand why your business how your business kind of is moving and getting through what are pretty amazing times actually in all of these industries I cover, it would be a more than welcome call. So I'm actually looking forward to the question and answer session. I don't know what else you guys want to know from me, but thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate it.
At breakfast, one of the fellows at the table was reminding me that used to be growing up in Delaware, you read the Wilmington papers during the week and the Philadelphia papers on Sunday. And I told him, I know why that is. The reason, as it was explained to me, is up until the 70s, the daily papers in Delaware were owned by the DuPont family interests. And that had pluses and it had minuses. And one of the pluses was that the News Journal, or the Morning News, had the best yacht coverage on the East Coast of the United States. They'd send a guy out to Bermuda, you know. But one of the not so positive aspects was whenever there was a, you know, DuPont plant explosion or a particularly juicy DuPont divorce, You didn't read too much about it in the Wilmington papers, and the Philadelphia reporters would come screaming down in their old black Fords, and they'd just have a field day, and the Philly papers would sell a lot of issues down here. When I worked at the News Journal in the early 90s, it seemed like there was almost a deal between Knight Ritter, that owned the Inquirer, and Gannett, that owns the News Journal. It, you know, we don't come our side, we don't come your side, you don't come our side. You know, there really wasn't that kind of coverage across the border. I worked at the Inquirer on and off for 20 years. I mean, what I've done is every time I had a couple more kids, we're up to six now, and I needed a raise, I would leave and I'd go somewhere else. And they'd miss me, and so they'd pay me more money to come back. And this is a career move I would recommend for anybody that finds themselves in a mature industry. Ellen Roberts, you know what I'm talking about. Ellen, like myself, went up and worked in New York for a while. And you come back here, and they're like, oh, you've been in New York. You know, I'll have to pay you more money. That's a good thing. I'm not sure I'd try it right now in this environment, but it has worked for me a couple of times. So. But, you know, it's a lot of fun covering business in Wilmington because there's so much going on. You know, credit cards, chickens, corporate charters, chemicals, right, those four. All the C's. You do that, you're covering the bases. Banking. Well, you know, I left, came to Philadelphia, and in the next few years, you know, Philadelphia was home to the first every financial institution in the United States, the first stock exchange, the first commercial bank, the first real savings bank. And it was my job at the Inquirer the first few years I was there to close them all down. They all got sold. But I left behind me in Delaware a very robust economy. We had two auto plants. We had the smelliest refinery in the East. We had the last big independent commercial bank in the Third Federal Reserve District. We had the biggest credit card company in the. I don't know what you guys did to them all after I left, but they're all gone. I mean, it's a terrible thing. Put it in perspective, in Philadelphia, we thought we were losing all our companies in the 1990s. And, you know, there are no more people working downtown Philly today than there were 20 years ago. The office rents have not gone up, you know, which means they've gone down. The city is fairly robust. But what's happened in the region is really surprising. Over the last 25 years, you know, Philadelphia has developed, the region has developed into the home of the biggest cable TV company that just bought NBC, the biggest financial software company, the biggest mutual fund company, the biggest food service company, the biggest pharmaceutical companies all have research labs in the region. Services really are the big thing, and it's much more regional. It's not this tight little group of people in downtown Philadelphia running things like it was in the 60s and 70s and for 150 years before. And it's a harder group of companies to cover. They are outward focused. They don't have a whole lot of interaction between each other. But, you know, the area has really transformed and continues to be robust. Somewhere in Wilmington and in Delaware today, I guess we have to hope are those kind of companies and those kind of people that while so many institutions that we have depended on all these years, you know, are fading away and disappearing. Bank of America just announced yesterday that they lost $20 billion out of the credit card business over the last 2 years. They paid $35 billion for it, you know. That's not going so well. Where are the seats? And yet there's a number of people that used to work for that company that are up on Silverside Road running much smaller companies. The fellow running Sallie Mae is an ex-MBNA guy, the fellow running the facility here. So, you know, and as reporters, you know, we're always chasing. You know, we saw these companies closing in Philadelphia. That was front page news. We didn't always see, you know, how rapidly Comcast or SunGard were growing until they became really big. And I think, you know, more proactive reporting, I think we would have picked a lot more of that up, you know, as it was happening. I think the relationship between us and you is fundamentally adversarial. I mean, it's very nice of you to buy us breakfast. I really like that. But, you know, my colleagues are talking about, are asking you guys for help. I'm glad you're here. You know, I've called some of you from time to time, and you've been helpful to me, you know, more or less or not. But I got, you know, good Nikki Lavoie, who's is one of the best-natured people in Delaware. I got in an argument with her just over breakfast, over the definition of symbolic and material. And, you know, Ted Sekala, who just got, you know, canned out of Wilmington Trust for running it into the ditch, when he got the job 15 years ago, I went in his office and I told him the same thing I told his predecessor, which is Leonard Quill, and that is, I may like you, but I'm not your friend, you know? And I'll cheerfully write about it when you record record profits. You know, I'll pick your numbers apart and see what I can find there, but you know, I'll report that. And the day you get indicted, I'll cheerfully write that too. And of course, in Ted's case, he wasn't indicted. He was just fired and his company sold because, you know, he didn't have proper credit controls and told people to sell when they shouldn't have been selling. And, you know, those are the kind of big, fat, ugly business stories that usually get written after the fact. You know, the company, the problem, the enormous problems that the DuPont company had over a 20-year period in just trying to get its business right and figuring out whether it was an oil company or a chemical company or what it was. And, you know, the people who got paid many millions of dollars to bungle those decisions and the people who lost their jobs and careers as a result, you know, that's a big, ugly story. And we tend to cover those after the fact. When we're really doing our job, when we're really paying attention, when we're really up there, you know, we see the problems as they're happening and developing. I mean, I got a couple of calls from people that worked at Vanguard Group during the last financial, you know, meltdown in the early 2000s. And these people were crying on the phone and saying, I've been fired and I don't understand why. I always said positive performance reviews. And, you know, I didn't write about that immediately. We did a little digging. It took more than a year. But we eventually determined that, you know, Fidelity and the other big mutual companies were laying people off and they got unemployment benefits and they sometimes got called back. Vanguard wanted to be a place that never laid anybody off. So what they were doing was they were telling all the managers, well, of every 10 people, we're going to do like GE does with its MBA managers. Every 10 people in your group, you're going to find one who's substandard and you're going to fire them. And, you know, that's one thing when you're dealing with hard-charging MBAs, right, that are expecting that. They know they're not all going to be CEO, and they're going to get compensated for the risk that they're taking. It's another thing when you're dealing with these $40,000-a-year people that are, you know, taking orders and getting one week of vacation, they go to the shore, and that's the big thing for them in life. And all of a sudden, after 20 years, they're told they're substandard. So I write a story that was half what's different under the CEO for the last couple of years that's making this company grow a lot faster, and half the cost of that is they're getting rid of all these folks. And Vanguard hit the roof, and Jack Brennan, the CEO at the time, sent a delegation of people to complain to the publisher about me. And then about 2 months later, he had a big meeting at the cafeteria and apologized to people. And the new CEO, a couple years later, when I asked him about it, said, we don't do things that way anymore. You know, we learned our lesson. And it was one of the rare instances in which I thought we really kind of got our hands around a situation, you know, while it was developing, put it out there in public. You know, we didn't even say this is wrong, this is evil. We said this is what they're doing. And people outside and within the company read that and said, my gosh, this is awful. You know, look how it's making us look. Look what we're doing. We got to find a different way to deal with this set of problems. And, you know, I had to feel it, you know, if the Wilmington Trust, you know, we had done a better job, whoever was covering Wilmington Trust at the time, being down in Sussex County and looking at the so-called, you know, seafront homes that we're financing, you know, 20, 30 miles inland. And, you know, wondering why this bank is making loans of a kind that other banks have stopped making. You know, there was a little bit of that kind of coverage. There were one or two of the stock analysts who cover the company who are usually very positive people. You know, their company wants to keep getting business. But some people were asking those questions. And, you know, in retrospect, you can say in so many of these business and financial stories, we should have hit it harder, we should have hit it earlier. What I do today is very different from what I used to do as a business reporter, and it's a response to the internet and the different way that people get their news. I mean, when I came into the field at the end of the 1980s, I was a clerk. You know, I was paid by the piece to do stories basically on the side, and that became my full-time occupation very quickly. There were weeks I made $200, or weeks I made $600. I had a wife and a baby and a mortgage, so it was a very exciting period of life. And in those days, the Inquirer did not take you if you were a correspondent and make you a reporter. You had to go somewhere else and make your bones. So I went out to Gary, Indiana. I had covered Camden for the Inquirer, and I was now covering Gary. And I thought, well, what's next? East St. Louis. You know, I'm gonna do the trifecta here, and just the worst cities in America. But they're great places to cover. People in Camden, people in Gary, they want to talk to you. They want to tell their story. It's much easier than covering Cherry Hill or Greenville when you're a stranger and don't know anybody. And, you know, because rich people, you know, they have some pretty clear ideas about themselves and their community. And very often they're right. And sometimes, you know, from other people's perspective, they're just off there somewhere. But whatever, the point is that they have a definite perspective. And like in interviewing them, you know, it's like every question you ask is a challenge to them. And people don't like that. I mean, people in my family sometimes, you know, I have an email conversation with my sister and she'll tell me things and I'll ask her five questions. And what do most people think? Well, you're questioning my veracity. you're questioning my competence. No, I'm a reporter. This is what I do. It's okay. I'm chairman of a Boy Scout troop. You know, we've had people who were just really taken aback when you ask them a lot of questions during the course of the meeting. You know, it affects your life. You know, I can't imagine two reporters going out, you know, dating or getting married. None of you are married to reporters, right? Oh my gosh, that would be hell. My wife's used to it. Again, we have six kids. She has to be used to it. But the point is, it can be seen as very adversarial to ask those kind of questions, to try and turn over this kind of stones. And with everything you guys are sending at us, all the press releases and everything else, most of which is crap from the news point of view, some of which is very interesting, a lot of which turns me into directions that you might not be expecting, I might not be expecting, but there does turn out to be a story there. It just might not be the story that you're selling. Excuse me for getting a little off track. I was paid by the piece. I went out to Gary where I was a staff reporter. I had a great time out there. My wife got pregnant with twins, so we moved back east. Philly still wasn't hiring. Actually, they were hiring, but at that time they were hiring females with Ivy League master's degrees. And as soon as that hiring editor went to Columbia, to her reward, I was the next guy they hired. But for the next 4 years, I was in, because I didn't have a master's degree. Also, I wasn't a woman, but that's okay. I mean, generally speaking, that was redressing a very severe imbalance in which white males are most of the reporters in this country. And for a while, they tried to balance that out a little bit better. I don't think they succeeded for the most part. So when I came to Wilmington, you know, the job had been vacant for 6 months. They wanted somebody to cover the banks. The last guy they had in the job had gone to work for one of the banks, for MBNA. And they had a very hard time finding people who both felt they were competent to cover economic issues and, you know, who weren't already making a real salary, you know, as opposed to a journalistic salary. It's just hard to find where those two sets intersected, where you had somebody who had the arrogance to believe they could cover financial institutions and the knowledge to do so and was willing to accept, I think it was $35,000 a year, $37,000 a year I started. So after 6 months, they found me. They called my old boss and said, would DeStefano ever go to work for a bank? And I think the boss answered that bank would fail. So they said, he's our boy. We're going to bring him in. We're going to be okay. And what he meant was that I would ask too many questions. Anyway, I had a lot of fun there covering Wilmington Trust and MBNA and the tax shelters, the Delaware tax shelters. I actually got detained in the IMP building one time. The IMP building was where Wilmington Trust used to keep all its tax shelters. They had, I think, 200,000 companies were supposed to be based in that building. So I engaged the guard in conversation and went to the computerized directory while I was talking to him about the Phillies or some subject I knew nothing about, and was writing down the names of many of these companies. And then I told him, well, I want to visit, you know, Shell Trading Holding Company. Oh, well, they look like they're up on 22. Okay. I went up to 22 because I already knew from the reverse directory that there were 200,000 companies on 22. So I walked in and started asking the clerks, could I talk to somebody from each of these companies? And by about the 30th company, and they keep putting me onto the same line, they had security and poor Charlie King, you know, who was Ellen's predecessor until he got run over on his motorcycle. Good man. And they very gently hustled me out of the building, and they asked me to submit my questions in writing, which they never answered, but circulated all over the legal department, I heard later. And I wrote a series of stories about the business in Delaware. We thought of it as a great expose. Look at all the taxes that aren't getting paid in other states. The stories I wrote at that time, you know, one of them ended up cited in a Yale Law Review article, another in a Harvard article. And becoming the basis for reforms that were enacted in Ohio, Maryland, and North Carolina, and several other states. But the attorney for Wilmington Trust called me a couple years later and said, you did a great job because we got so many calls from companies seeking to set up Delaware corporate tax shelter. We were very happy. I said, I only wish you'd cooperated on top of that. And he was the retired general counsel by that point, which is another thing. You know, a lot of you people are seeing very interesting stories that you can't say anything about at the time. And from time to time, you may disagree with the folks running the company and you think, well, someday I'll let all this out. Well, and CEOs are the same way. They love to talk once they've retired. But once you've retired and it's 2 or 3 years later, nobody much cares. The time to slip those stories out, people, is now. we're still here. I was at the Inquirer 8 years covering financial institutions in Philadelphia, and then our company got put up on the market. Knight Ritter decided to commit corporate suicide. They kind of saw what was coming and got out while they still could. Smart decision in retrospect back in 2006, 2007. and we were sold, and then we were sold again. And that became my story. So I had to cover my own company. That was a great deal of fun. I never realized until then how much support you get out of having a newsroom you can go back to, colleagues, some of whom may hate your guts or vice versa, but they're your colleagues and they live in your world and you understand each other. Well, suddenly when you're covering your boss and you're covering your union leader and you're covering the Teamsters down on Delaware Avenue, who when they're angry at you, the best policy is to go over and see them and take your medicine and then explain very briefly what you're doing, and that will cause them to continue to talk to you. I mean, they're reasonable people, but you have, just like the longshoremen in Wilmington, you got to show a certain respect. And that was fun for a year, and the first sale and the second sale, and then I got tired of comforting crying people, and so I decided, you know, I'll see if I can still leave here and do something else. And I went up to New York for a year and worked at Bloomberg for 9 months. Had a great time there covering financial institutions. Got a wonderful phone call from a banker who works for a company that Ellen Roberts used to work for, not the one that she currently works for. And he said, I know what you're doing. There's a whole bunch of us that do this, married guys. We go up to New York and we work there for a while. It's great. You know, we don't have to deal with our angry wives who are crying children at night and their problems. You learn to eat sushi. You learn to see opera or read the books you never read before. He said, but don't do it for more than a year, because after a year you will find that you get involved in alcohol or other women. And you've got to either, which if that's your intention, you're in the right place. You've got to either move that family with you or you got to go back. And after 6 months, I started saying the symptoms. I won't say which, but I called the Inquirer and the union, the publisher and the editor all wanted me back, and they paid me, you know, my Bloomberg wage, not my Bloomberg income, but my Bloomberg wage after taxes to come back. And very soon I developed a whole new thing I was doing. See, at Bloomberg, you work very hard and you get really good access and it's a lot of fun. And you get used to filing every day. It's like a wire service. I mean, this does not impress radio. But, you know, newspapers, very often you get a couple of days to work on a big story. You may do a few items in between, but, you know, you can go deep like we did on MBNA in some of the stories we wrote, like we did on the tax shelters in Delaware, the Delaware Investment Holding Companies. But when you're pounding away at it and covering the company in little pieces as it develops, if you're doing it right, you're developing very large stories at the same time as you're writing very small ones. Well, we took this to its logical conclusion. You know, they told me, do you want to write a blog? And I said, I don't know what the hell that is. I mean, I've seen people do them. I don't think much of them. They said, well, you've always got these little things coming in. Why don't you try writing some of those up? I said, all right. They're not quite stories. I did. And started getting a lot of hits. Today, it is the most popular or second most popular from month to month of the non-sports blogs at the Inquirer. People really want to read business news that they can't get anywhere else. Well, two-thirds of the items are local. Probably a third of them are national. I really was very dissatisfied with the way that a lot of the national organizations were covering the financial crisis. I felt that there was a lot of good reporting, but it wasn't accessible to the average reader, and what was being given the average reader really wasn't that good. So I would do my own take on those things, since I've been covering Citi and JP Morgan until recently. And, you know, we got a lot of readers for those items. So most of what we do is local, little companies, big companies doing stuff in Philadelphia. Oh, by the way, I did take some time while I was writing full time to write a book about Comcast in 2005. I wouldn't show it to them before it was published, so they stopped talking to me. They always complain when I write about them now. They don't complain to me. They complain to my boss's boss. Biggest company in town is very pissed at me for stuff I did 6 years ago. I think it's a nice book. But the blog, yeah, the blog. And in addition to the blog, I write a column. And it was originally one day a week. Then we took it to 5 days a week, and it became my full-time job. And then when we accepted a contract that included a 2% pay cut, I said, I'm going into 4 days a week. So on the fifth day, they just take something out of the blog that wasn't in the column, and they put that in the paper. It's kind of like I have five columns. I post anywhere from 2 on up to 6 or 8 pieces a day in the blog. Usually, but not always, one of those pieces is the lead of my column, and I might do 2 or 3 other pieces in the column. On Sundays in particular, I tend to make it all one subject. It's fun for me because I get to write about lots of different things. I do some politics. Delaware, I live down here still, and the congressional delegation is very accessible down here. So, you know, I can get Tom Carper or Kuntz or Ted Kaufman to you know, talk about issues of the day, committees they sit on. It's harder to get the senator in New York or New Jersey or Pennsylvania to do that just because they have so many more demands on their time. But, you know, what you lose is you don't get the depth that you can do when you have half a page or 2 pages to write about Reliance Insurance blowing up or some other spectacular scandal. And I worry that as more and more of us are moving into these immediate interims, we're just now getting smartphones distributed at the Enquirer and doing more and more stuff that's applications. The broader you get, the more we're responding to press releases and stage news and announced events. You know, the harder it is to do those digger pieces, those larger pieces in which I won't say we're the experts. I say we can talk to the experts and the people who are out there really seeing things clearly and really in a position to make independent judgments and bring that forward. That does get harder to do when you're spending more and more of your time, you know, chasing smaller pieces. The news business is broken. This happens to industries. I mean, banking knows a lot of the problems that we know. You know, banking has multiple distribution platforms. You know, remember back in the 70s when ATMs came out, Wilmington Trust stuck some of them in branches. They were really happy. They stuck some of them in branches right at the teller window, thinking people are going to use machines. We don't have to pay people anymore. And they got really upset when they realized you need both. And then 800 calls, call centers, the same thing. Computers, the same thing. The banks have to compete with 4 or 5 different distribution systems. We got these companies like ING that you work for, right? That only have 1 or 2 distribution systems. Their costs are much lower. They can pay better rates. It's very hard. The banks have just had to cut so much out to compete. The news business is in very much the same position. We make most of our money still from print, but our costs are much lower in online, but we don't get the ad dollars from online. You kind of have to do both. It would be so much easier if we could just go to online. That's not going to come for a while yet. And reporters are getting employed. They're more and more getting employed by very focused, very single-purpose publications. Bloomberg's a subscription service. You need $17,000 a year to get that. They give away a lot of their news for free, but it's not their main business model. I believe that, you know, the demand for our kind of skills is going to do nothing but increase. But the mass media, where it's accessible to everybody, is very much in danger. And it's not at all clear what the model's going to be where you continue to get what you have gotten for the last 50 years, which is lots of information accessible on a daily basis, you know, through the different communications media, radio and print and online to lots of people. We don't, it's not too clear, you know, how that's going to work in 10 and 20 years. Thanks. Are we going to ask our own Q&A, or are you going to run that for us? Okay.
Yeah.
You see, ask reporters to talk about themselves, and we don't friggin' shut up.
Yeah. We're coming close to the end of our time, but I know a few of you do have questions. So podcast Steve has a mic here. And we got one up already.
Joe, I'm Ellen Roberts from Wilmington Trust, and Joe, I'd just like to say to you that I doubt Ted Sakala would return your call now that he's retired. Go ahead and try. I have a question mostly for you, Joe, and Jonathan, based on what Amy said earlier about how embargoes work well. And given how everything has changed in terms of the immediacy of news, especially through the web or Facebook or Twitter, I wonder how realistic it is for us to consider the embargo as a tool. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Let me say how she likes it. And I was shaking my head while she was saying it, because my needs are different from hers. No disrespect. I don't like embargoes. I never did. I always thought it kind of makes the reporter a collaborator, you know, with this organization that wants to get the information out on its schedule and in its way. I mean, it's enough that we got to listen to exactly the way they want to phrase it. To have to do it on their timing is kind of outrageous. I think it's more outrageous now because if this thing is being circulated among news people and people within the organization, with all the social media that exists, with email, with Twitter, with the rest of it, that information is probably out to a lot of people. And to have to sit on it, to agree to sit on it or suppress it for a day or a couple of days, you know, to me is at the very best impractical. I more appreciate it when, if I'm familiar with an organization or an organization can make me familiar with their basic business and what they do, so that when the news comes, I'll be able to act on it fairly quickly. To me, is a much preferable situation.
Well, I guess I agree with that in certain circumstances. I mean, I don't think an embargo should be used as a tool just to get a newspaper to kind of act when you want them next. So, I mean, for example, I got asked to embargo something by Fisker Automotive, was holding an event in Delaware. They were holding the event on the morning and asked me to embargo the news for the next morning. And when there must have been 50 businesses at the event, and to me that was just a blatant tool to try to get us to not, I mean, actually, you know, and they told us, they said, look, you know, we don't want tons of people showing up to this event. And so if you could just hold off when you use it, you know, when you're going to print this news or put it online, that'd be really helpful for us. I don't think that's the way an embargo should work. I mean, if there's a legitimate reason for waiting to print something and it's not already out in kind of in public dialogue anyway, I think an embargo can be very helpful because it allows us time to kind of add value to the story. So I think an embargo can be used as a tool. I just think, you know, it has to be in a situation that makes sense for both people, as opposed to just kind of putting off a story that's already out there and people are already talking about.
I want to know, is there anything that's a complete turnoff in terms of the pitch or receiving a press release? Is there anything that PR professionals do that's just a complete turnoff for you?
I think Amy hinted at this, but it's amazing how many releases you get that are written backwards. They're not written in the English language. I mean, because we do it every day, we feel like it should be really obvious that we want to know, you know, how does this affect our readers? How does this affect employment? What is the cost? What is the value? You know, the numbers up top, players up top. You know, make it simple. If we got to dig for it, you know, either you're hiding something or there's really nothing here is kind of my gut reaction.
I'm Ted Sikorsky from Goodwill of Delaware. And I guess the question I have is, each of you talked about press releases and email communications. Do you have a preference as the best way to get news or to get information? Is it still the old-fashioned, I don't think anybody still faxes press releases, but to email a press release or to just pick up the phone and give you a call, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
I am completely obsessed with my Android device and check my email more often than I should. So email is definitely the best way. I don't even know, to be honest with you, where the fax machine is closest to me.
Yeah.
That is true. See, now you know I'm not lying to you, Nikki. So, but yeah, I mean, I also don't mind a call, but I'm kind of, I absolutely will see information if it's sent to my email and pay more attention to it than I should.
Yeah, I agree. I have no idea what WDEL's fax number is. We get some calls for it, and I actually have to look at my business card to find out every time. And email, you know, I get it right to my phone. I can get it while I'm at another story, because sometimes I'm covering 2-3 stories a day, and I don't necessarily have time to have that conversation right at this moment. So I think email is definitely the best way.
It is fun to look at the faxes, because the people who are still faxing are usually pretty out there. But an email without attachments is my favorite. If I want to know more, I can call you or dig it up.
Hi, my name is Doug Epler. I'm with Tipton Communications. And first off, our president, Dan Tipton, heads up the Delaware chapter of the PRSA. So I know on his behalf, he could have been here today. He certainly would have thanked you guys for coming out and providing this information. My question for you is regarding a concept that I'm wondering is whether or not it's outdated these days, and that's exclusivity between someone providing a story and a news source. Is that still a relevant factor for you guys? Is that still an enticement? If someone comes and says, all right, I'm going to put this story out there, I will do it direct to you, and, you know, obviously they have some kind of expectations as well, but is that still something that's relevant and realistic these days, or given
the only time that ever comes in to me is when, you know, the editor, it's a borderline kind of a story. The editor will say, well, does anybody else have this? And if the answer is not as far as I know, you might say, well, let's take a little more time and go a little deeper. But generally speaking, again, the assumption is if you're telling me, there's other people who know, and I better get that out there sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I guess it depends. I mean, there's probably 3 or 4 people that I can think of that I would really love to talk to that I think aren't talking much. I don't know. A lot of the emails I get about exclusivity are one expert or another who will talk to me exclusively about one subject or another that I'm probably not writing about. So, I mean, I think that, so I think it's probably a case-by-case basis. I mean, I'm always just looking for good kind of voices who can help illustrate one, you know, one topic or another. So I think it's typically less about exclusivity and typically more about people who know about business in Delaware and what and what we're writing about. So that's why I said earlier, I think maybe just reaching out and asking exactly what our needs are and what kind of stories make us say, okay, absolutely, we have to get this in the paper. That's probably better than just firing off an email and saying, I have this exclusive person that you didn't know existed yesterday.
I think we want them out.
Well, thank you everyone for coming. Just two quick things. This week, the Delaware chapter launched both a Facebook and Twitter page. If you have not found us yet, you can find the Delaware Facebook page by typing Public Relations Society of America, Delaware, into the search box. And if you have not found us on Twitter, we're at PRSADE. And that is all. One more round of applause for our speakers, please.
If you have comments or suggestions about these podcasts, you can drop us a line at steve@professionalpodcasts.com. You can also call our comment line. It's 856-861-6146 in the U.S. and 44020-7193-6146 in the U.K. You can also follow me on Twitter, where I use the name Podcast Steve. We produce these programs in the studios of Professional Podcasts in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, on the web at professionalpodcasts.com. For everyone here at the program, this is Steve Lubetkin. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.